Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tune.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half of your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are coming to you from Inaka with Chef Nikki Nakayama. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us in the most unassuming slash best restaurant. We can say at least on the block. right? And then we can expand out to where it is probably one of the best restaurants in the city, if not America. So there's so much to talk about. I don't think I've had more questions for this. I have two pages of single type stuff. I wish I took this good of notes in college. But I want to start with, you know, we're sitting here in this temple that you built, mm-hmm. to kaiseki, to cooking, to everything. And, you know, in a type of cuisine that can be led by tradition or devotion to, like, the rules and things like that, and that can be sort of your guiding light. What you say is that you are led by your own intuition.
Right.
And that cooking is one thing that you can completely trust what you're doing. So why, in something that can be seen as so rigid, do you allow sort of like this, not, I don't want to say free form, but your own intuition to guide you?
The one thing, well, one of the main things that I love about kaiseki is because so much of it is a philosophy rather than a strict what we're doing is a very loose interpretation, like you said, but it's more of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like all these, there's this structure to it. But within the structure, what is so amazing about it is you can sort of adjust the structure to match the things that make sense for me personally. For example, initially when I started Ennaka, the idea was trying to create a restaurant along the lines of the experience that you would have in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And then in time, I started to think about it. Well, kaiseki's real philosophy is about trying to showcase what is close to you, what is near to you. And then I was thinking, well, we're importing all these things from Japan,
mm-hmm.
and how is that being local and really sticking to the rules of kaiseki? Then it started to make sense for us to sort of alter course and start to implement this whole idea of California into our kaiseki, because here we are in Los Angeles, California. We should present food that is somewhat, when you're eating it here, you realize, okay, I'm not in Japan,
mm-hmm.
but there's some ideas and there's some techniques and some flavorings that all come from a Japanese heart, but it's all interpreted with Japanese visions and Japanese lens, but then the ingredients may not necessarily be Japanese.
So, the ingredients aren't the only things that come from Los mm-hmm. Angeles in this restaurant. You also come from Los Angeles, right?
Hey.
Right? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in K-Town area.
Okay. That's fine.
It'll ring twice.
It's fine.
Okay.
It's not that professional on this show.
Okay.
So you grew up in K-Town.
Right.
Arguably might be the hottest spot to eat in America. If you talk to like all the chefs, they're like, oh, you got to go to K-Town, LA.
Yeah. There's a lot of great places in K-Town now. When I was growing up, there was a lot less, there weren't as many restaurants.
Yeah.
So we were only there until I was in about 12th grade. I mean, when I was 12 in 6th grade, and then we moved out to the San Gabriel Valley.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so there's a lot of ethnic food out there.
A lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff. Now, food important big in your family growing up?
Food important big. Not necessarily very fancy food. Just food in general was big in our family. Like, we really enjoyed eating.
But the idea of cooking for yourself and eating things like that. Mom cooked, dad cooked?
Mom cooked, and my parents have been in the seafood business since I was about 10.
Yes.
So I was, you know, recalling the other day to our staff how for dinner, on several occasions, I remember just getting a Dungeness crab. It's like, here, dinner. And then all of us had one Dungeness crab each, and we're like, okay, that's dinner.
If that could be every night.
Like, each of us had one, and then we, like, hold it up and take a picture. It's like, hey.
So you were doing the holding the giant Dungeness crab seafood photo trend years before.
Right. All of us had one, and we'd hold it up, and then it's like, well, how do we eat it? And then my dad would just, like, break off the leg and start, like, here, use your teeth. And then we all bit on it, and we're all, like, eating.
So your father owned the seafood business. Your mother worked in there.
Right.
So was it a family? It was
a family
affair.
Right.
Were you encouraged to get into food? Did you know at a young age, you're like, this is the family business. I want to get into it. I want to be a chef.
It was funny because when they started their business now, I was 12. And I remember going there and working in the warehouse. My brother was like, oh, you know, your job is to sort of fill out the order of what people are going to order.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember being in that warehouse. It was freezing cold. It smelled like fish. And my whole idea was like, I'm never going to do this business.
I got to get out.
This smells like fish. And I don't want to be in a cold like place. And this is, I need to find another career. It's like, I'm not going to peddle fish for a living. But I'm still peddling fish.
Yes. We always go back to where, right? It's so funny how like you go, I'm never going to do this.
Right.
And you get older and you're like, I'm doing this.
Right. I was like...
But you did go to culinary school. And you went to culinary school, not in Paris, not in upstate New York, but in glorious Pasadena.
Yes. I did go to the school was called the Southern California School of Culinary Arts, and that was before it became a Cordon Bleu program.
And what year is this?
This was 96.
Okay. So food had not quite reached its, like, mainstream prominence. And your parents were sort of into the idea, half into the idea.
My mom was initially like, no, you can't. You know what's so funny about my mom? She's always suggesting things. And then when I say I'm going to do it, then she finds reason why I shouldn't do it. This is the most hilarious thing about her. Because when she visited me in Japan, she's like, you know what? The food scene here, before culinary school,
yeah.
I actually went to Japan after high school for a bit. And then she's like, the food scene here is amazing, and you should think about going to culinary school here because this is, like, something you should really learn. You know, Japan has such a wonderful food scene. Then I was thinking, oh, it would be amazing to go in Japan, but then there's, like, this whole equivalent of, like, this Japanese TOEFL that you have to pass in order to get into some sort
of... I mean, it's a hierarchy.
Yeah. And then you have to, like, be able to, like, read and write, like, 100% Japanese, and that's not my... forte?
No.
Growing up in Los Angeles. So I thought, oh, it probably makes sense to come back to the States and do it.
Yeah.
So I told my mom, hey, you know, maybe I'll go to the culinary school that's nearby. And she's like, what are you thinking? You can't go into this restaurant business. Do you know how hard it is to be on your feet all day long? And plus, you're too short.
But I feel like
reasoning.
You're the type of person, if someone says you can't do it, you're going to do it.
Yeah, that's always been my thing. It's like if somebody says I can't do it, it's like, why? Why can't I do it? I'm going to do it. I'm going to show you that I can't do it.
So you go to culinary school.
Mm-hmm.
What did you take away from there?
Well, the first day when I was in culinary school, I was like, what am I doing here? I can't believe I'm cutting carrots into little strips and little chunks of squares and dices. What am I doing with my life? But the greatest thing about cooking is... the more I did it, the more I loved it.
Mm.
It was like, I've always been, I love cooking because there's something about it that is very instant gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have an idea, and I go out and I do it, and then 30 minutes later, there's result. And something about that is very satisfying to me, versus waiting months and months and months for something to happen.
Unless you're doing fermentation.
True. That's a good point.
So you finished school. I know you spent some time at Takawa, which is this famous Brentwood sushi place. But then you start thinking about Japan again, right?
Yes. I actually went to culinary school with a mind that I would go back to Japan after I graduated.
So mom, Mom, yeah. What are you doing? Mom, this is for you, right?
Right. It's like I have a plan. It's not just, you know, I'm not just going to go to culinary school and do something else after. It's like, I have a plan. I'm gonna go back to Japan. I'm gonna go, like, really train and learn Japanese food.
Did you always want to do Japanese cuisine?
I think there's a part of me that has always loved European cuisine.
Sure.
But there's some really deep level of understanding that I have for Japanese food that just, it really makes sense to me. I remember walking into Takawa restaurant after having done a few months in an Italian restaurant. My first thing when I walked into Takao restaurant was, oh my god, it's the smell of dashi, and I felt like I was home.
I mean, home is where the heart is, right?
Right.
Now, you had family in Japan as well, right?
Yes, yes.
And you're thinking about Japan. How much did you actually know about Japanese food? And I ask that being like, it's like you grew up in a Japanese household and you worked in a Japanese restaurant, things like that. But did you get to Japan and were like, oh, I don't know anything?
Yes, of course. It was like, you know, growing up here, there's only so many ingredients that were available at the time.
Because this is the late 90s. It's not like today.
Right.
It's not like today where it's just like, oh, I need like a bushel of shisho leaves. Like,
right.
Like this. It's just like...
Everything, even like the selections were so limited back then. And then it was like when I went to Japan, it's like, what is this mitsuba thing that I've never had in the States? And it's just like a completely different approach to cooking. And then the ingredient was so, I love that so much of the food is ingredient driven.
I mean, it's all ingredient driven.
Yes, yes, yes. So everything that's made is based on the ingredients that's available.
Yeah.
And to have it so fresh. For example, the crab was just caught today, you know, a couple of hours away, and we're eating that tonight.
Do you have photos from Japan of you holding up crab?
I don't have photos of
okay.
holding up crab.
Maybe they don't. Unfortunately not.
Right.
But importantly as well is that you go to Japan, and that's, is this the first time you had, you hear about kaiseki? Had you known about kaiseki? Or was it like you sort of heard about it, like a cool band, but then you went to Japan and you're like, oh, cool, like it's playing, like you can go to a show?
It was actually the summer before I went to culinary school. I went before I came back.
Right.
I was at my cousin's place, and then they had served me this full-on kaiseki meal that they served their guests. And I was so amazed by it because the idea of... Visually, it's really stunning because they lay it all out from the beginning. So it's like you're sitting down and then all of a sudden right in front of you, there's like 17 different dishes of varying sizes and colors and ingredients. And it's just happening all at once. And it's like, wow, what is this?
And it's not a progression. It's not like course after course.
You could do it as a progression. The very fancy ones do it as a progression in sets of threes.
Mm.
Whereas, like, if you were to go to an inn, a Japanese inn, they do it. They lay it out for you mostly all at once with some things that are meant to be hot served a little later.
Mm, yeah. Does the inn still exist?
Yes, yes.
Shout it. Where is it? If I want to go. Maybe I want to go on vacation.
It's in a city called Niigata, and it's Tokamachi City. And it's... I always relate it to how L.A. is to Big Bear, so it would be, like, the Big Bear area.
Oh, okay.
In relations to Tokyo. It's very famous for rice and sake, and it's also known for heavy snow.
Everything you said sounds amazing.
Yes, it's an amazing
place. So you were there for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
What is, I mean, we could probably spend the rest of the time talking about what you learned there, but what did you take away from there as something that you've carried with you today?
I think the most important thing that I was able to learn is what Japanese food should really taste like. It's like, this is what is really authentic Japanese. This is what the heart of Japanese food is. And it's, I can't, every time I cook, it's, I'm always reminded of that, those tastes that I have there.
When, and understanding tastes, beginning to understand kaiseki, when you started to really get kaiseki, and, you know, it's traditional and it's balanced, and there's obviously just hundreds of years of just of the service and the sort of the theatrics of it, was at that time, did you start going like, maybe I want to do it a little differently? And did you say that to anyone, or were you like, I can't say that to anyone here because they will look at me that I've gone crazy?
I thought I would. I always have loved tasting menus. When I was at Takao and then I saw him do tasting menus, it was always so exciting because there's so many variations to the food that you're going to eat as a diner. And when I experienced kaiseki, it was like, oh, this makes sense to eat like this because the variety itself is so exciting. It's like an event. It's so fun. And then I honestly thought that I wouldn't want to make a very traditional kaiseki restaurant because it didn't feel very genuine to me.
Right.
Like, I felt like, oh yeah, you know, I'm born and raised in LA, and I'm here in Japan learning about Japanese food. There's only so much of it that I can really capture.
And bring back with
and
you.
And bring back. And then to falsely present it as like, hey, this is my background, I've been doing this forever. It felt very disingenuous. And then I thought, the best thing that I could do is interpret this whole experience from my perspective, and whatever comes out is going to be genuinely something that I create that's from my experience. So I can't help but put this American influence into it because, hey, I grew up here. I know the food here. And when I taste something, if something's missing, it might be something that just naturally comes from my own experience.
Yeah. And so when did you know it was time to leave Japan and return to LA?
I was there for about 3 years, and I thought I have learned as much as I possibly can at my cousin's inn, and the timing felt right to sort of come back to LA and find something to do that was going to continue my education in culinary.
Awesome. Well, we're going to take a short musical break. We are going to talk about your time in LA and the building of this small restaurant I think it's one to watch, but Anaka, just you stay tuned. We have a live performance from one of our favorite bands here on Snacky Tunes live on heritageradionetwork.org.
That funny what you do to me. You're my honey as far as I can see. Then you told me that you found someone new. Ain't it funny what time can do? It ain't that funny, 'cause I'm so blue. I could love a million girls or two, but I'll never be over you. Money, a car or two, I'd pay you rent. Well, I'd even steal for you. I could break the law, commit a crime or two. Ain't it funny what love can do? Yeah, ain't that funny?
Ain't that funny?
What you do?
What you do?
It ain't that funny, 'cause I'm so blue. I could win a million bucks or two, but I'll never be over you. Oh, one more time, Johnny. I'm gonna hit every bar in this doggone town, have a smoke, pop a pill or two, drink some whiskey and eat a big old steak too. Ain't it funny what love can do? Yeah, ain't that funny?
Ain't that funny?
What you do?
What you do?
It ain't that funny, 'cause I'm so blue. I could drink a million beers or two, but I'll never be over you. I think I'll have a drink with a girl named Sue, but I'll never be over you.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Chef Nikki Nakayama in the beautiful Anaka. So you left Tokyo, mm-hmm. left Japan. You're back in LA. You've just spent all this time doing kaiseki, and you want to open up your first restaurant. What was your first restaurant in LA?
My first restaurant in LA was a sushi restaurant.
not where I thought you were going to go with this. But, and what year is this?
This is 1999.
Okay, so I first came to your restaurant, I'm going to say 2 years ago, so 2015. That was the first time I heard of kaiseki, and I've been living in the food world for my entire life. So I'm assuming in 1999, a lot of people didn't know what kaiseki was, right?
Right, right.
Is that why you opened up a sushi restaurant? Was that your own decision? Was there anyone else involved?
My parents actually helped shape that vision, because I think the idea...
Was your mom like, you should open up a kaiseki restaurant? And you're like, I'm going to open up a kaiseki restaurant. Your mom went, maybe you should do a sushi restaurant.
Something like that. No, I didn't feel ready to open anything close to a kaiseki restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I loved all these elements of it. And I think with everything in life, when you learn things, it takes time for it to sort of be put together, even in your own mind, how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, it was like everything was new. Everything was still... I was still in the process of learning things. And I don't think... For lack of a better word, the cake was baked yet.
Sure.
Right. So
still adding the ingredients.
Right. It was just still something that was someday. It was in my mind that, oh, someday that would happen, but I wasn't ready then for it.
And the name of the restaurant was?
Azami Sushi.
And how did it do? How was it?
It took a long time to get it really into a place where I felt like this was going to be okay. Because initially when we first opened, it was just like, oh, let's just open a restaurant. And it was like, Thursday, what day should we open? Let's open Thursday. And then we just rolled up the gates and opened, and we all just stood there.
I mean, how did you get the word out about a restaurant in 1999?
I had no idea how to get a word out. It was
right.
We'll just open and see what happens.
But the word did get out.
Yes, it took a bit. It took a bit. And
define a bit.
It took about 3 years to really get it to a place where I felt like, okay, our business is good.
I gotta say, if it took 3 years to get a restaurant going today, it would be two other restaurants by that time. How did you hang on for so long?
I think there was this feeling like, I can't let this fail. Mm-hmm. Because if anything, there's always this point where like, well, if it came down to it, I would be the server, I would cook, I would wash the dishes, I would do every single position in this restaurant if I have to keep it going. So that was the mentality that I had. And then it was just, you know, building it slowly and letting it happen. And luckily, we were able to pull together a very strong neighborhood support.
Mm.
And there was we had so many great customers that still visit me today.
That's amazing.
And it was just like building of this relationship and getting to know what guests really like to eat and just a constant learning from mistakes.
I mean, learning from mistakes and customer service and a neighborhood spot, I really think are the three pillars of a successful restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point during the run of the restaurant did you start thinking that kaiseki and the next move and like going back to like what you sort of like was inside your heart and what you really wanted to do?
I actually toyed with a little bit of kaiseki on the menu.
Okay.
Back then we had a 5-course and a 7-course, and it was
It was called kaiseki on the menu.
No, it was just called tasting menu. It was a chef's choice tasting menu.
Okay.
And then basically it was built
because people knew that. It's like, I know what a chef's
right,
menu.
Right. So we just built it off of the kaiseki philosophies and then the structure. And back then it was even then I thought whoever ordered it, if I could, at each time, if they did come back and eat it, that we would try to find something different for them to eat.
I mean, this is something that is absolutely crazy and amazing to say to me, is that people who come and have your kaiseki menu have a different menu every time.
Well, we try.
I mean, I would say as a diner, is that no one expects that. But, like, no. I mean, I would expect, you know, there to be, like, 3 or 4 staples and then maybe something new because of the season, something like that. But there's that story in the chef's table where you say that somebody came back in the chef from the first restaurant you worked in came back in the same week and had 2 completely different meals. Mm-hmm. Why? Like, why put that incredible challenge upon your shoulders?
Well, I mean, I already feel that when our guests come, we're already taking away some of their rights to choose anything from a menu.
Sure.
So I feel like it's our responsibility to provide a dining experience that's new and different. And I think part of the fun of dining in this style where you don't have a menu is that element of surprise. So if you were to come back and we're still able to surprise you on some level, it makes the dining experience feel like a new one. Like you've gone to a new restaurant, it's a different thing, and I think that's...
But if people have a favorite, can they ask for a favorite?
Like, Yes, of course.
Because sometimes you dream about, it's like,
right.
It's like I've been dreaming about this cod like this.
Yes.
So Azami's done.
Azami's done.
You shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
You start doing pop-ups, right?
A little bit, yes.
A little bit. And was this the start of the cake, maybe the batter's made, and maybe
right.
You're slowly sliding into the oven? Like, how did the pop-ups go, and were you, at this point, officially saying, in your mind, and calling it Kaiseki?
I was, in my mind, calling it Kaiseki, but still calling it Chef's Tasting. And the thing was, when I had sold the sushi restaurant, in my mind, I was like, I'm going to travel. I'm going to go and see the rest of the world and, you know, maybe work for somebody else and learn more things. Then my sister was like, hey, I just found this space and, you know, it's perfect. Let's do something together. And it's going to be ready in a month. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And then she's like, you figure out what we're going to do with it. And then I was so...
You're like, thank you.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
I was really mad at her for it. And then I was like, I can't believe I'm stuck here doing this place. And so I was like, fine, if I have to do this, you know, the daytime we'll just do this deli. And then I was driving to work, on the way to work, and I listening to NPR. They talked about this restaurant in Philadelphia. Actually, it's more in the suburbs. And it was about how the chef had gone back to his hometown with his wife. And then they had a deli in the morning. And then at nighttime, they did this chef's table. And it's one of the hardest reservations to get in the country.
Amazing.
So I was like, that's what I'll do. I'll do a chef's table thing at nighttime. And, you know, because I already actually had this Ennaka space. I had secured the space already, but I was waiting for all the permits to come out.
Sure.
It was a whole, like, 2-3 year process. So I was like, fine, I'll do that. And then at nighttime, I'll just start practicing my ideas on people who would want to come and eat.
So now you have everything. You've lived in Japan. You did the culinary school. You worked at a sushi place. You had your own sushi place. You understood kaiseki from the source. But you started to develop a unique take, which we'll call California kaiseki.
Mm-hmm.
What is California kaiseki? How close does it resemble to Kyoto kaiseki? And what type of ingredients were you allowing yourself to use?
I thought, okay, there's some staples that make a meal very Japanese.
Sure.
So all the ingredients that do that, I have to keep on the menu. But in terms of what I can do to interpret different tastes or add different tastes to it is basically something that I felt should be really representative of my own experience. So doing California kaiseki, for example, we have a pasta course on the menu, which is you're not going to find in a kaiseki restaurant in Japan.
Which has also become a signature dish.
It has, yes.
What is the dish?
It's our abalone pasta.
It's delicious.
Thank you.
But was there any part of your mind that was saying, like, you can't do this, the family's going to come and they're going to freak out? Were you going, like, no, they're going to come, they're going to love it. I'm going to show them.
It was more like, no, I'm going to do it, and they're going to love it, and I'm going to show them. Because when I thought about that abalone pasta dish, it was like, this is exactly the kind of food I want to make, because there's parts of it that's so Japanese, and there's parts of it that isn't. And it's like right in this weird sweet spot, right in the middle where it can be one thing and it can be another. And that's exactly the identity that I have. Because, yes, I'm Asian and I grew up in America, was born and raised here, but there's a part of me that feels like I totally understand Western culture, like, to this level that's what I've been taught, that's what I learned in school. And then if you ask me about Japanese culture very deeply, I don't know And I can't pretend like I know because sure. that's not my education. So it's like there's this really weird spot right in the middle where I belong, where I get to take something that's really awesome from Japan and then something that's really awesome that's American, and I get to put it together, and that's my experience growing up here, and it's all represented in this dish.
Yeah, but the beauty's in the weird spot.
Yeah,
right? So the beauty, like, the new stuff, the exciting stuff is in that weird spot, and the uniqueness. So you're doing the Japanese deli, mm-hmm. all the permits come in for Inaka, right? What was it, how long did it take to open? What was it like when it first opened? Did people right away, or just, like, was it, they just got it?
It was funny because back in the deli, it was like where we'd grown accustomed to doing about, there was only 14 seats
sure.
in this restaurant. And we'd grown accustomed to doing about, like, four tables a night, two tops. And then we got Inaka, and then there's, like, 9 tables, and there's, like, four tops and 5 2 tops. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, my God, we have 19 people. What am I going to do?
Those extra 5 are a killer.
Right. You know? And then I opened this restaurant without so much thinking of, like, oh, I should set a time for seating. There's, like, all these things. And then our first initial guests that came to eat were, like, dining, like, 3-4 hours for their dinner because it was taking us so long to just get everything out. There wasn't enough of a system.
Yeah.
But so thankfully, we've, like, come to this place where, like, okay, we can get people out in about 2.5 hours now.
And you also play.
It's like 5-hour dinner.
You're like, dude, you don't have to go home.
Right?
But you can't stay
my
here.
My brother's like, your dinner is taking way too long. I was like, I'm sorry.
You're like, you're like, no, actually, brother, you say, congratulations on opening this restaurant. But with the California Kaiseki and you know, you're still playing to the seasons, and I know you do traditional restaurants, but I know that you also work with Dock to Dish, which is giving you fish you don't normally see,
right,
like, on the plate for Kaiseki restaurants. So even though it's very traditional, you're using ingredients you would never find at any other Kaiseki type of restaurant.
Right.
And so have people come in who run their own tradition? Have people flown in from Japan and come here and been like, what is this? And do you think that this type of restaurant would succeed back in Kyoto or something like that?
I feel like, for the most part, even people from Japan come and dine at our restaurant. I feel very supported by even that crowd because I think they understand what it is that we're trying to do. And then we do make it a purpose to explain to them that, yes, this is Kaiseki in philosophy and in theory, but so much of it is determined by ingredients as what Kaiseki should really be about.
Mm-hmm.
And because we are in California, we like to represent that this is a California-style Kaiseki.
Yeah.
So for the most part, even people from Japan are very supportive of that. Mm-hmm. It's just once in a while we'll get people who have visited Japan that aren't necessarily Japanese that come and ask us, why aren't we doing a very traditional Japanese
goes
Kaiseki?
To Kaiseki in Kyoto restaurant once.
Right.
Thinks they're an expert, right?
Right. They're like, well, why isn't it like this? And why don't you have that on the menu?
It's like,
why
listen,
do you have pasta?
I was in Kyoto in January, and I know that I'm eating at your restaurant in August, but it wasn't like it. It's like, all right, there's a lot of things wrong with your statement right there. But in addition to the ingredients and the protein, it's also women run. You and your partner, Cal, run it. It's,
right.
You know, I mean, one could say you're the one of the only, if not the only, women-run Kaiseki restaurant, if not American, in the world. I mean, that's an amazing thing.
We feel very fortunate. And in all honesty, Carol and I often talk about it, and we don't know how this would be in Japan, like if we could succeed in the way that we have here in LA, in the same way that would be in Japan. Because I think the society as a whole in Japan is still very uncomfortable with women doing jobs that men traditionally do. So having said that, I think the success that we are experiencing is definitely a result of being in Los Angeles. And then we're really appreciative of that.
I mean, I'm appreciative of you doing the food that you're doing. So what's next? I mean, you're full every night. right?
Yes.
For the foreseeable future?
Yes.
Where do you go from here? Where do you go from here with the ton of accolades, the nominations, and being fully accepted and proving the family wrong? What's next?
We have a lot of fun things on our agenda. A lot of it being, I'm really interested in doing a lot more themed menus. Mm-hmm. For example, we did the whole 100% California ingredient kaiseki dinner.
Was that tough?
That was really hard because we were not able to use any ingredients that were imported. So
I'm sure you use a lot of Dr. Dish fish on that, right?
We had to use a lot of Dr. Dish fish, and we also have this wonderful Japanese seafood supplier. He's from Wildlife Fresh Fish, and he also sources locally, and he brings us fish that he's performed ikijime on. So, for example, black cod can be served as a sashimi or a sushi dish because it's taken care of properly. And that's not heard of in Japan. Like, you would never eat black cod as a sushi or sushi.
Let's expand Japan. Like, we started to expand that this is the best restaurant on the block.
Right.
And then we can say LA in the world. That is something you can't find in Japan.
Right.
Maybe all of Asia. And maybe all of the... I mean, that is something I've never heard.
Right. So that is one of the... That was one of the most amazing discoveries. And we worked with people, like local foragers as well. One local forager who brought us all these ingredients that were so new to us, and like we never imagined using or incorporating that into Japanese cuisine, but we're able to find a way that using Japanese philosophy and the ideas and techniques. But it was really hard because there's so many things that I realized that we depend on that are imported.
Yeah.
So we had to make our own miso, we had to make our own bonito, and it was crazy. It was really fun to learn.
Yeah.
And
then really fun to go back and say,
right,
we are importing again.
Right, like some things should just be brought in and we'll do whatever we can. But to better answer your question, we're looking forward to doing more themed menus where it follows an idea and then somehow tie it to... The whole idea for the theme menus to tie it to some sort of charity. So, yes, I get to explore my creative ideas and, you know, force people to eat these ideas that I have, but at least it'll be beneficial on some level to society by contributing it to charitable work.
Awesome. Well, I only have one more question for you.
Okay.
I know you play guitar at home to relax.
I do.
And there was a quote from Chef's Table that I love that was, you know, when you talk about plating, there's a song in your head.
Mm-hmm.
What is that song? And are there any lyrics?
Okay, the songs all vary based on the mood that I'm in. And sometimes I don't know why, but there's 80s music going on in my head.
Okay.
Okay, yes.
Well, you're a child of the 80s.
Yes. And there's, like, songs that are recent from, like, you know, like, there's, like, sometimes there's Adele, sometimes there's Wham.
Mm.
Sometimes there's Shalimar, sometimes there's like...
A real Shalimar sashimi dish, right?
Right, like, you know, sometimes there's like Earth, Wind, and Fire. There's just a lot of things going on.
Maybe a little September song.
Yeah,
right, when you're playing.
There's Beatles too, and a little bit of Joe Cocker. There's everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Well, Chef, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for showing LA just amazing food day in, day out, year in, year out.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Of course. And if people want to find you online, are you on Instagram?
Our restaurant is.
Okay.
So it's at Ennaka Restaurant.
Awesome. And if people want to make reservations or come by, how far in advance?
Right now we are opening our reservations 3 months out every Sunday morning at 10 a.m.
People, it is worth the wait.
Thank you.
We have another live recording from the archives on Snacky Tunes and a live performance coming up next here on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Everybody knows. Shout it for a minute at least. Survey, survive. How we gonna stay alive? Mason's time. Keep the walls up for a while. You may feel protection might be a veneer or a souvenir.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back. That was just a track from Mountain Animation, and earlier you heard from Johnny Lamb, two of our favorite performances from Snacky Tunes. We're live in studio with Anique Monet. Welcome.
Hi,
and friends, lots of friends.
Yeah.
The name does not imply there are four other people. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. Normally have people go around the room and say who they are. You want to shout it out who you are and what you're playing today? Or any you can do the intros.
Sure. There's Daryl Johns on drums, Ben Sechrist on trumpet, Eamon Lebo on bass, and Monet Freeman on keyboard.
Did you pick Monet because the name is
No, actually, that was the Craigslist.
Oh, really?
There's two Craigslisters in this room.
Is it Monet looking for Monet? Not looking for art?
She spells it differently, but okay. it was kind of a cool little serendipity moment.
So you're from Delray Beach.
Yeah, South Florida.
South Florida. And you grew up playing covers with your dad, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He used to have, gigs at, little places around, little 3-hour things, and we'd play. I'd play the uke and sing along with him.
What did dad play?
He played the guitar.
Was it, your kind of, South Florida dive bar cover band, or what was the
band? No, it was, my dad and I alone, acoustic,
okay,
doing our little thing.
Oh, just, father-daughter time.
Yeah, totally.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And you did ABBA and Fleetwood Mac covers, right?
Yeah. Well, we did a Fleetwood Mac, and then there were other things. But, yeah, we would sing ABBA songs and whatever. That was a big...
What was the Fleetwood Mac song?
Landslide.
Of course. Seems like the perfect, father-daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially after the live record where she dedicated to her dad.
And yeah, this one's for you, Daddy.
This one's for you, Daddy.
Yeah, that's exactly the one.
Yeah, and you're like, hey, I got a song for us.
Yeah.
And how did you graduate into writing your own music, or did dad kind of be like, no more covers, time to do your own?
No.
Write a song for me.
No, I don't know. I started doing it in high school, and I was with another band where it wasn't my music, but then it was kind of funny. I don't know. There was a falling out with that band, and then I started doing my own thing, and then the label Beyond Beyond is Beyond heard Relapse, which we're going to play today. And they were like, let's do a record.
So. Did you reconcile with the band? Have you mended fences yet? Is it still? Or do I need to interview you 10 years from now when we finally patch it up?
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
They're okay. Yeah, it's fine.
Things are fine. So what brought you up to New York?
That music. And I was going to go... Well, I went to Parsons for a while, but it was both music and art. And I just... Yep, I'm still here doing music and art.
What type of community did you find up here? How did you begin to find your compatriots? Besides Craigslist.
Yeah, Craigslist. No, I found, I started going to Smalls a lot, actually, and I had
for
a lot of...
For those who don't know Smalls.
Smalls is a little small uh-huh. jazz venue. It's really cool. Actually, Ben works there and plays there a lot, and... I had some friends from high school that came up as well that went to the New School, which is part of Parsons, or Parsons is part of the New School, which is where I went as well. And that's how I found Smalls. And then, I don't know, you meet one person and you meet the next person. And Daryl also plays at Smalls pretty frequently. And it's just a very, everybody is in everybody's band kind of a deal. But it's really cool. And everybody's really supportive of each other. And
how did you go about putting your band together, again, outside of Craigslist? Or what elements? Because on the first record, you played everything yourself.
Yeah, it was just me and a MIDI keyboard and my uke and my computer and just in my room in the dark. But otherwise, I had to find people. So I looked to Craigslist, but... it was a bit of trial and error. There was, in the beginning, I had a drummer from Craigslist, and then I had a drummer from some, it was a girl, or a boyfriend of a girl that I worked with in American Apparel, and then, I don't know, it's just like people just come and go, but...
Stacking shells, you're like, do you play anything?
Yeah, right. No, exactly. It's like, hey, I'm like getting my hair cut, seriously. I'm like, do you know anybody that plays drums?
I mean, it's amazing when you're just starting out in this city where you're just trying to, you're just throwing anything out there. Like, do you know people who are into music at all? And I think I have a friend, and then you begin to build your community around that.
Totally, yeah. It's really cool, actually, how that works.
And how did you end on this final incarnation? Is this the full incarnation? I know we're a small studio.
This is the...
We got everybody.
Yeah, this is it. Okay. Yeah, we're all here.
Everyone made it.
Yeah, yep.
And how did you feel that this was the right mix of people to represent your music?
I don't know. I mean, everybody just gels really well, and... I don't know. It feels... It just... It, you know, you feel it in your gut.
And you mentioned your record label, Beyond Beyond is Beyond.
Yes.
Which greatest record name of all time. How did they found you? But they say that their record label is made up of dreamers, vagabonds, losers, and users. Where do you fit within that spectrum?
Dreamers. Duh.
Trick question, obviously.
Yeah, no. I'm dreaming.
And what is it that they found in you and you saw in them that you felt was the right home for your first record?
I think, that's a tough question, actually. But I was in a band that was on their label already, so I already kind of knew them. And Dominique is the co-owner with Mike, and I got dinner with her once, and we started like forming a little, like, she's kind of like a sister to me in a way. And I think they could hear, they heard something in me that was like needed to be broken out, and they gave me that chance to like fully come out.
I mean, there's a lot of trust in putting your art into, you only get one release for that first time,
right?
So there's a lot of bands that have gone with labels that have, I won't say let them down, but maybe not delivered.
No, it's a very like, it was totally like 50-50, we're in this together, like
cool. What is one thing that they did for you that you felt really gave you the extra kind of confidence or the next step to put this out into the world?
I mean, just like every time I'd send them a song, they were just on fire for it, and it made me feel so great. I mean, and I'm like, cool, so let's keep going, and I'll send you another. And then we slowly put together the album, Phantom Letters, which I think we have a few tapes left hidden somewhere.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah, let's do it. We'll play Nowhere.
Live here on Snacky Tunes. Not just a musician, but you do all your own visual for the band too.
Yeah. Yeah, I like to make music videos and whatnot.
Most people will have their music inspire artists to do their work. So how do you create a loop that continues to evolve and not just be pulling from the same sources?
I don't know. I mean, speaking of the word dreamer, a lot of my art just comes from dreams that I have. And sometimes, I mean, that feels like cheating because I just wake up and I'm like, I'm going to do that now. But I pull from there and other things and, make videos and music and pictures or whatever.
I mean, it's only cheating if you determined it that way.
Okay. It's not cheating. I mean, it was in my head, I guess. I dreamt it just.
Yeah. Are you wake up in the middle of the night and take notes, like notebook by the bed, or do you wait till the morning and hope you remember it?
It depends on how tired I am, I guess. Sometimes if it's like a really like vivid thing where I'm like, I have to wake up right now and write this down, then I'll do that. But sometimes I usually remember them, and then I'm like, Dad, I just had the weirdest dream last night.
He's like, make a video and dedicate it to me.
Yeah, right.
And does the music itself sometimes lead from the dreams, or is it always the dreams and music lead into the visuals? Or how does the ecosystem feed and evolve from each other?
I don't know. I mean, it's sometimes the music is like something that comes from like heartbreak or that kind of a cheesy thing, or just emotion. And then I think I don't know. Somehow they end up melding together, but there's no like specific set way that I do it,
And as the project continues to evolve, you're starting to add new instruments and add new members. Yeah. How is that folding into the next steps in the career?
Well, I really like this next album. Going to be working on this year and finishing finally, but using real instruments. I really, really seriously love horns. I've found, and the last show that we played, people really seemed to dig it as well. And just collaborating with really talented musicians and friends, and it's I want more than just my own mind. I like other people, giving their ideas too.
With using the Nords and the MIDI controllers, you kind of have open game to any type of sound, any type of creative. There's no creative restraint.
Right.
So adding in other people and adding in real instruments, how do you feel that's affected the creative process and allowing other people to have part in the vision?
It's been great. If someone feels something and they're like, I think I'm going to do it this way. And then sometimes it ends up sounding better. And I wish that I could like go back and re-record the other songs, but it's cool.
And is the evolution of playing together with a larger band also affecting the final outcome of the upcoming record? Is it a living thing?
Yeah, because sometimes if I think this goes for anybody, but if you're just like jamming on one thing and you keep going and going and going, eventually someone's gonna do something different. And then sometimes it's like, whoa, actually that sounds really good, let's remember that, let's do that.
And how will you know that it's ready? I mean, evolution and creativity can always, especially if you're pulling from a jazz background where improvisation is such a big part of it, how will you know that your songs are done, especially if it's a new creative process?
I don't know. I mean, I think just once everybody's nodding and like, yeah, this sounds great.
It's like everyone into this. Cool. Let's play for an audience. They're into it.
Yeah.
Done. Record.
Right.
Can we hear another song?
Yeah. Yes. Sure. This one is called Relapse and the start of Phantom Letters. How it all began. I can't sing anymore, I can only just scream out. I can't see anymore, I can only just scream out.
Desert hours now, wander, the place is wrong. It is
We're coming off of one of the most historic protests, if not in the country, in the world. And your label, Beyond Beyond is Beyond, because I just want to say it one more time, yeah, just came out with a compilation, Jamming the Trump Agenda, a sonic fundraiser, which might be the best concept.
Yeah,
a
totally.
A sonic fundraiser.
Yeah.
You contributed a cover of Jolene.
Yes.
So few questions to follow. One, what is the basic concept of the record and who are they benefiting?
Yeah, so they're all the proceeds for the album go to the ACLU and the Sierra Club, and those are both just fighting for the preservation and like protection of the world and its inhabitants, and like you know,
and just basic good rights.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Which is a good thing.
Which
yeah.
is a great thing.
Yeah.
And how did you pick Jolene for the contribution?
To be honest, it was just a song that was stuck in my head for some reason. Like, and they just happened to ask me, hey, do you want to contribute to this? And I was like, hell yeah. And, yeah, Jolene, it was something that I kind of wanted to cover anyways and just kind of went for it.
And who makes up the rest of the compilation?
Oh, it's like all Beyond artists. I couldn't even name all of them because it's just... pretty much every single Beyond artist is on the compilation, which is really awesome.
It's amazing to see all the different ways that people are contributing to someone who is completely against their own ideals. And I know that we said that we would not go into this, which we won't.
Yeah.
But it's good to see that creativity seems to win out as, you know, just focus your energy into this and
right.
a group project and making something new and showing that the arts has value, even though they are consistently under attack and
yeah.
the threatening of loss of funding, etc.
No, it was really amazing and like refreshing to be a part of something that everybody could come together and make art for.
Where can people get it and how can they contribute?
Yeah, so if you go on to Beyond, you can find the album there and it's $10, but you can donate more if you'd like. And yeah.
And please donate more.
Yeah,
it's
please.
Like two beers and a shot of whiskey.
I donated.
As you should. And if yeah. not, head over to ACLU or find a charity.
Right,
you
right.
set up $5 a month, just
yeah.
easily deductible.
But also, I mean, it's cool. I mean, you get music out of it, too, yeah. if you do the Beyond thing. So.
Right. I mean, just anything helps.
Right.
So you mentioned the new record is being currently written, and we can leave it at that. But any other upcoming tours, plans, what's next?
Yeah, we have a show tonight at the Bowery Electric, and I think we go on around 10 p.m. And then next Sunday, we have a show at Bazaar Bushwick, not to be confused with the Brooklyn Bazaar or whatever.
Oh, what's the difference? Or where's
I
that
don't
one?
Know. There's like one of, I
right.
don't know. But Bazaar Bushwick, or Bazaar Bar, if you type in Bazaar into Google Maps, it'll show. But
B-A, not B-I. Bazaar.
Bazaar, sorry.
Bazaar.
Yes.
Like, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Am I saying it weird?
Yeah, well, anyway.
Bazaar, whatever.
Yeah, bizarre. Got it.
Anyway, yeah, next Sunday, too. And that one's going to be kind of crazy because I think it's from, like, 9 to 4 a.m. And we're not playing from 9 to 4 a.m. Anique Monet. You know, it's like, it's going to be a lot of bands, but it should be fun.
Each song with a 20-minute jazz outro.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, we want to make sure we get in time for one more song, but where can people find you, get the first record, get updates for the upcoming record?
Yeah. Well, I'm on Facebook, Anique Monet, A-N-N-I-Q-U-E-M-O-N-E-T. And otherwise, you can get the album Phantom Letters on Beyond Beyond is Beyond's Bandcamp. And yeah, that's pretty much it.
We want to thank Chef Nikki for being our food guest today. Please remember to stay strong. Do something positive. Don't just think marching is an action. Take action. What's the name of the last song you're going to take us out with?
Salt Veruca.
Thank you so much. We will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Thank you for listening. Oh,
tickets or pass or through. Cross fingers and a back to through. How will go drop down that shoe? If you want to feel real paradise,
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Whaley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.